Good evening. Welcome to McNally Robinson. I know you're all still getting settled. There are seats up here in the front. If you're running out of space in the back, or if you'd like to get a better look, you can move up to the cafe tables. We have chairs up here. I know everyone's still getting settled. We want to go ahead and get started because we have quite a long lineup this evening. Thank you so much for joining us for this amazing event. We have an outstanding lineup of authors this evening. Most of them have books for sale. They're on the table over here. They'll ring up at the register over there, and the proceeds, when you buy those books, go directly to Seeds of Peace. We're going to have Leora Skolkin-Smith tell you more about this event and Sophie Lechner tell you more about Seeds of Peace, and then we'll get right to the authors. So enjoy, drink wine, buy a book. There's a donation jar as well, and please welcome Leora Skolkin-Smith. Thank you.
Hello. Oh, God, it's just wonderful that we're all here. I know that's corny, but it's how I feel. I want to show you something. I can't pass it around, but this is a letter from Lebanon to my mother. It was written in 1938. I didn't think of it until I saw the very place it was written from bombed in the news in the recent war, and somehow it jogged my memory. And I went to look through my mother's things. I didn't know how to introduce this wondrous event, having you all here, having all of us together like this, but by sharing this letter, because I think it so poignantly contrasts then and now. I had wondered again how I had, why it bothered me. And I realized that this brought home to me the senselessness of this war more than any speech I could ever prepare for you. We have so many remarkable writers, and I sure wish we could hear them read longer than the 5 minutes they all have, but it's wonderful that we're all here, and that is the homage to peace we all wish to make. But please do spend time afterwards looking through their amazing books, all now in the bookstore. And I just want to share a few lines. It's corny, but it's just something that really moved me. My mother was chaperoned. She was born in Palestine. She was born to a Jewish family. Beirut was known then as the Paris of the Middle East. And she went all the time to Beirut. And she fell in love with a Muslim, and this is what he wrote her. "Dear Miss Rachel, today you asked me to confess to you and tell you my sins. You promised me to keep my secret as a secret and never tell it to anyone, even your sister. So I am going to confess it to you now. It is very simple and can be written in 3 words, but they are 3 words which mean to me more than all the words in the world. I love you." By reading it, you may laugh, and, you can laugh, but I take it very seriously. Yes, I love you. Poor guy, right? Love you with all my heart and soul. You are to me like an angel, and I want to kneel down in front of you and worship you like a pilgrim. So without further embarrassing this poor gentleman and my mother, I just felt that I wanted to share with you long ago what it was like for a young girl from Jerusalem, a Jewish girl, to go to Beirut and meet a man, a Muslim from Lebanon, and fall in love. I give you to all our wonderful readers.
Well, I'm really pleased to be here. I'm Diana Abu-Jaber, and those romantic Arab guys, they're all the same. Oh, thank you. Yes, so that's a wrapper full of brownie crumbs. So anyway, you can see where my mind is at. So I thought I would read to you from my new book, which is The Language of Baklava. And it's sort of centered around my dad's recipes. I grew up in a family that's Jordanian and Palestinian and Irish. So it's a classic combo. And we talked a lot about peace and war and politics. That was the milieu of my household. And the section that I thought I'd read to you is a scene of war between myself and my father. And a lot of this book is about the war of the family, the war between children and parents, especially if you're between cultures, as I was, an American, Arab, Irish, Muslim girl. And the way this went is that my auntie came and my auntie brokered peace. And it starts with the week that my aunt and I spend together, and she gives me a lot of advice about how to be a woman. Marry, don't marry, Auntie Aya says as we unfold layers of dough. Just don't have your babies unless it's absolutely necessary. How do I know if it's necessary? I asked. She stops and stares ahead. Ask yourself, do I want a baby or do I want to make a cake? The answers will come to you like bells ringing. She flickers her fingers in the air. For me, almost always, the answer was cake. I'm silent as I stare at the cup glittering with sugar. This is advice, but it feels like pressing my ear to the wall. I don't want her to notice how closely I listen, or she might stop talking. After years of assuming that the purpose of all this cooking and working was to produce and grow babies, this is the first intimation I've heard of another way through life. It's the first time I've understood that my aunt, with her house filled with friends and siblings and lovers, does not have children of her own. And then there are recipes in the book, and what we have in this section is a recipe for Mona Lisa cream puffs, because you should always put a secret in your filling. Okay, so you have to read the recipe to know the secret. And then there's a series of advice that she gives me about life and growing up and how to achieve peace in one's personal life. And I'll just read a couple of those to you. Make sure to boil the attar syrup clear and then add the essence of rose so it will bloom. She leans against the oven. If you're going to kiss a boy, try to remember to eat a little parsley first. Also think of a compliment for his mother. That's always good. Never let anyone tell you what to say or feel or think. If you can't say it out loud, then write it on a piece of paper. The thing about cinnamon and ginger, they're pretty, yes, but they also bite, which is more interesting and can be dangerous. And when a man tells you something, I don't care what it is, look at his eyes and his hands. Don't worry too much about the words. If you can't see his eyes or his hands, don't believe any of it. And then she goes into a little section about food. People say food is a way to forget, to remember the past. Never mind about that. Food is a way to forget. She's showing me how to make the phyllo dough that constitutes the basis of so many Middle Eastern pastries. We stand over the table, wrapping the dough along long, narrow wooden spindles to press out the fine papery sheets. As far as I had known, phyllo originated in wax paper columns and freezer cribs. Food is not sweetness and families and little flying hearts. Look at this, she cries, holding up a spindle. Food is aggravation and too much work and hurting your back and trapping the women inside the kitchen like slaves. I stare at her. Food is robbery. Did you know that? She stands straight. Let's say your country hasn't existed for very long, and you announce to the world, yes, my family invented baklava. There you have it, an instant history, a name. But Dad says, I struggle to remember what he says. Dad says that everyone invented baklava. Aunt Aya rolls her eyes. Your father, he's the worst of the worst. He thinks he cooks Arabic food, but these walnuts weren't grown from Jordanian earth. And this butter wasn't made from Jordanian lambs. He is eating the shadow of a memory. He cooks to remember, but the more he eats, the more he forgets. I bite the edge of my lip. That seems sort of dramatic. Dramatic? You think food isn't dramatic? She demands. You want drama? How about peace in the Middle East? She yanks the apron from her waist and flings it at the back of the chair. I'll tell you how to do it. Watch. She sits down, straightens her arms on the table, and stares at me. I wait. I wrap my hands around my waist. I don't understand. Who am I? She snaps. I am America, Israel, England. What am I doing? She waits another moment. I'm shutting up and listening. She draws the last word out so it hisses through the air. I am all the presidents and the kings and the prime ministers, the highs and the mighties. Listen, she spells the word in the air. The woman who made the baklava has something to say to you. Voila, you see what I'm doing? She picks up an imaginary plate and lifts something from it and takes an imaginary bite. She closes her eyes and says, oh, this is such delicious Arabic, Jordanian, Lebanese, Palestinian baklava. Thank you so much for sharing it with us. Please will you come to our home now and have some of our food? She puts the plate down, brushes crumbs from her fingers, and says, so now what did I just do? You ate some invisible baklava? She curls her hands as if making a point. I looked, I tasted, I spoke kindly, I invited. Do you know what else? I keep doing it. I don't stop. If it doesn't work on the first or second or third bite. And like that, she snaps the apron from the chair into the air, leaving a poof of flour like a wish. There is your piece. And that's it. Thank you.
Hello, I can barely compete with this because I've not had a chance to really write it properly. But I wanted to introduce Seeds of Peace, for whose benefit this evening has been put together very kindly. I am Vice President of Communications for Seeds of Peace. I wanted to thank all of you for coming to this event. I just want to tell you a few words about Seeds of Peace. It was created in 1993, so that was 13 years ago, and it was... the mission is to empower the leaders of the next generation. I think we can all agree that the leaders of this generation have not so far done such a great job. And whether that progresses or not, we believe that really empowering the next generation is how we will accomplish peace in the Middle East. We use the tools of coexistence and conflict resolution and have a lot of programs for these youngsters. And the first program that they come to takes place in Maine, and it is a 3-week camp during which we have Israelis, Palestinians, we have children from, or teenagers from the whole Middle East, from Egypt, from Jordan, and also from the Balkans, from India, from Pakistan, so various regions of conflict. And they come and all live together for 3 weeks. And it is very intense. It's a transformational experience for all of them. They do dialogue sessions for 2 hours every day, which are facilitated and, from what I understand, can sometimes be a little painful. But they listen to each other, and they learn to listen, and they learn to understand each other and agree to disagree most of the time or sometimes. But they learn to listen and understand each other. They also do, of course, what you do in camp, sports, which teaches them trust and patience and all those qualities that you need to coexist. And after these 3 weeks, they go back to their countries, and they help to support and develop and implement a whole slew and variety of programs locally. So some of them are uni-national, so only in one country, but a lot of them are binational or multinational. And they revolve around education, business, networking, so a lot of different topics or even readings like this one. But you would have this in Jerusalem, for example, and you may have some Israeli authors and some Palestinian authors. So those are the types of programs that they do when they go back home. And the important thing is to continue the avenues for dialogue and continued interaction. And sometimes programs cannot occur in the countries because, as you know, there are a lot of constraints around checkpoints and being able to travel. So when necessary, we do also programs outside of the region. And, for example, today we're having an action summit, which is since the program has been happening for 13 years, we now have some seeds. We call seeds the people who have come to camp. Some of them are in their mid to late 20s now and are really starting to take an active role in their communities and some leadership roles. And we have brought 30 of the oldest of them to New York for 4 days. And they're actually working on putting together some programs and the whole program for the year in their different countries. And it's really exciting to see them. They're young, they're full of enthusiasm, and you would never think that they're from these warring countries. They're there, the Palestinians, the Israelis, and they're Arabs, and they're Jordanians, and they're all together, and they're having fun, and they're working together and laughing together. And this afternoon, there was just this little anecdote that happened. It was just so... It made us all teary-eyed in the back row. We were listing a bunch of programs that we wanted to accomplish. When I say we, it's really the seeds. And we had allocated the budget to them. And that's a very difficult exercise. You can imagine we're pretty short of budget. But and one of the Palestinian girls said, well, you know, for us to come across, it's so difficult. We have to spend the night, so maybe we should have a little more budget and... it could be a little difficult. She just wanted to make that point. And another girl in the audience raised her hand, and she says, well, you know, maybe we can make the Israeli program a little bit, you know, cheaper and you know, compensate that way. And it was just this very natural sort of spontaneous offering of more funds from the Israeli side so the Palestinians wouldn't have such a hard time. And it was just such a perfect example of the ambiance that, you know, the whole coexistence between them that I thought was wonderful. So to support all of this, we appreciate all efforts such as this one. And there is a donation. It's not really a box. It's more of a vase today. It's a bright blue vase over there. And we also have some forms if some of you want to do a credit card donation. And Aline right here from Seeds of Peace will give you a form that you can fill out if you want to donate to this. So thank you very much, and I look forward to hearing all these beautiful readings.
Hi, I'm Elisa Albert. I'm not going to read my own work. I'm going to read something that Grace Paley wrote. And this was 1991, so 15 years ago, and she's talking about the Gulf War. And this is from a speech that she gave at Harvard. I'm just going to jump right into the middle. I find it kind of eerily prescient. But the reason this war in Indochina had continued in this particular way was because of what was called a crisis of credibility. I don't know how to describe it exactly, but this fear of not being credible, of not being believed unless you were very strong and violent and offering more violence. It's very similar to, well, you know, we have often talked about how Asians and Indians and others need to save face, and we have treated that as a kind of backward idea. You know, you want to save face, but what are they going to do to their faces after they're saved? But we Americans, some of us, have the same need, really. We like to be credible, and it is really pretty much the same thing. And one might say it is really not a facial experience, this need. It's really a testicular one. But anyway, I'm making these connections in order to get on to our latest war, because a lot of you young people, well, you weren't even born at that time, and you keep wondering why people are always talking to you about Vietnam, Vietnam. It's really pretty boring in many ways. Still, it actually turns out that Vietnam is not only on my mind and my friends' minds, but it is so much on the president's mind and so much on our leaders' minds that they talk about it all the time. They are very much afraid that we'll forget about Vietnam, and yet they want us to forget about it. They want us to forget. They want you to forget about it, at least about American resistance. They don't want you to think about it. But it's this credible thing, and then it's this face-saving thing. And it turns out that we not only went into that war as fiercely as we did for credibility, but at the same time that we were making ourselves credible, we were losing face. So we lost our face in Vietnam, and that is why Bush and other leaders and the American public have to keep talking about it. They call it the Vietnam Syndrome. But what the Vietnam Syndrome is about, I'll talk about that a little later. In any event, once our leader pointed out this loss to all the Americans who really thought that they had kept their faces for the last 15 years, the people began to understand that they had really lost them. So the yellow ribbon was invented and appeared everywhere easily, as though there had always been a great vat of yellow dye in the middle of the country. And in the front of that ribbon, organizations, churches, all sorts of authoritative people, Congress and so forth, fell. Then they recovered, held up their yellow ribbon, and were declared present. It worked like that for a lot of people. But think about the war itself, the war that you have known recently, your most recent war, the Gulf War, which, because it was brilliantly executed, very few of you had too much to do with. She's talking to Harvard seniors. Young recruits were sent over, which most of you were not, although some of you could have been, and old reservists, really old reservists. For instance, there was a whole group of about 50-year-old men from Harlem who had been sent by accident into some forward position, which they were not exactly prepared for. What was the army doing with these old black men down there? This war really hasn't ended, and it is not going to end so soon. The Vietnam War, to this day, has never ended for the Vietnamese. All these years, the Vietnamese have been cruelly embargoed, so we are still at war against them, as far as I can see. As for the Panamanians, they are probably worse off than they were before we decided to defend them. And in the Middle East, as we now know, nothing is really much better. If anything, it is less stable than before. Thousands and thousands of Iraqis are still dead or injured. The Kurds, well, you know all about them, and we Americans really have a lot of sympathy for them, and it's the best part of us in a sense. It's something our country's always done extremely well. I mean, we put them in a position where they are practically slaughtered, but then, and I'm going to say something awfully cynical. I don't like to be cynical in front of young people, and I'm not really cynical, but I'm going to say this cynical thing all the same, which is that once enough of the Kurds had been slaughtered, we became very good-hearted and have probably taken care of them better than almost anybody else could. And you can compare that, in a sense, to the wonderful way we took care of Vietnamese orphans. Then we were strong enough. The truth is, we were strong enough to do that, to kill the parents, but we were also good enough to take care of their orphans. And that is in us also. One thing that is there, and it's a true thing. But one of the decisions our administration made, one of the worst as the Gulf War was beginning, was to stretch a great big wet blanket over the country. At least I felt like that. No air and no airwaves. We couldn't see or hear the war, the killing which might have saddened us. I don't remember that kind of silence since the McCarthy days. Our media actually allowed themselves to not receive information. We are used to them making a lot of noise. Sometimes we don't like what they say, but we're used to that general racket, out of which certain pieces of fact and truth often slip out and speak to us. This dampness concerned us so thoroughly, we couldn't react in our good-hearted way, if I can go from cynicism to sentimentality, which are closely related. Though we saw nothing of the war, the people were generally for it, with yellow ribbons and flags flying wildly. But once we saw the pictures of the Kurds on TV, once we saw a few facts and the truth, we were moved, affected by the sight, and began to press the government to take some sort of action. So, in a sense, the government's strategic decision to hide the truth from us was the smart thing to do from their point of view. Well, here we are right now, and we are at a point now where the Israelis and the Palestinians hate each other more than ever. Both of them are being driven quite crazy. The Israelis were driven crazy by Europeans 50 years ago, and the Palestinians are now being driven crazy by the Israelis. When I say driven crazy, I mean that people who are tormented in these ways are really made crazy with rage. People who have no homes, whose homes are taken away from them. And you don't have to go that far away to see this, because you can walk with me in my own city and see people who, if they were not crazy to begin with, are being driven crazy. And that happens in whole parts of the world where people are torn from their homes and their homes destroyed. It isn't just our wars that have made people mad. It's all the wars.
I'm Edith Shabbat. I'm going to read from Lost. It's a long narrative poem about personal loss and 9/11. And it has been cut a lot. I was home on 9/11. It was Tuesday, and I was getting ready to do the laundry. I needed to get quarters. I couldn't decide whether to vote first. It was only a primary, but I always voted. I heard a crash. I thought it was one of the speedboats racing in the river. I looked out the window. Fire was shooting out from a black ring around the top of one of the towers. I saw the second plane hit. Now there was another ring of flames. I saw things falling. Desks, I thought. Doors, chairs, computers. Anything but bodies. I turned my head away. I didn't want to see what I was watching. People jumping, holding hands as if on the way to a picnic or a party. They were lost in the sky above my head. I didn't want to be lost with them. I couldn't imagine the end of hope. I didn't know what to do. The doorman said he couldn't tell me, but if he were in my shoes, he would get out. I went back upstairs to get my pocketbook. I left $50 under the sugar bowl on the kitchen table for the cleaning woman in case she came. I debated taking a book. I thought I might have to sit on the Esplanade for hours. I double-locked the door. Downstairs, some of my neighbors were crying. Those are people, they said. There was no place to go except the river. I heard a swoosh. Looking back, I saw a cloud of dust coming through the courtyard set up for triage, pieces of wood and other debris swirling before it. I watched it race toward me like the ball in that Indiana Jones movie. Night fell, or was it that I couldn't see or breathe? I covered my mouth with my shirt. My eyes burned. I didn't die. I didn't know the building fell. I thought it was a bomb. No one cried. No one screamed. It was like being underwater. I put my arm out, groping for something solid, a bush, a bench, a body. I held on tight, shuffling along. In a restaurant, we drank water, rested. The waitress was crying. Someone said to rinse out our mouths before we drank the water. I found a used coffee cup on the table. I couldn't bring myself to spit on the floor. Firemen came to wash out their eyes. They said we had to leave. There might be an explosion. Out again through the side door, grabbing tablecloths and napkins to protect ourselves. I still have my tablecloth, laundered now but stained. I walked carefully, step by step, afraid I'd see something I didn't want to see, afraid I'd trip on something and lie there trampled under running feet. An old man in pajamas, robe, and slippers clutching his newspaper shuffled along. I thought I was dreaming. A man came running by, his mouth covered by a mask. "It's starting again," he shouted. I thought it was an earthquake. I didn't know more buildings were falling. We walked south in the dark through the Chinese restaurant to the community room already crammed with people. A pregnant woman, belly bulging, a nursing baby, a woman with two dogs, a woman on crutches, a few young men carrying briefcases. They must have come from the ferries on the way to work, the other men already at their offices, or on the ground, or lost. At South Cove, a flotilla of tugs, police boats, motorboats, prows pointed in toward the concrete embankment. I was afraid I couldn't climb up. I was afraid I'd fall in. Across the river near the Colgate clock, two men pulled each of us up to the ground. I thought we must be at war. I thought we had been invaded. And this was like Dunkirk, except we weren't soldiers. I was a crime victim. My building was a crime scene. Parts of one of the planes had blown in. It was rumored there were body parts. It was said they were looking for the black box. It was reported there had been looting. My apartment was cleaned professionally, courtesy of the insurance company. The cleaners came from Colombia, Mexico, Guatemala. They didn't speak English. They didn't wear masks. A daughter-in-law insisted I throw out Molly, my American girl doll, once given to me for my birthday, because she represented my era, the 40s, and she wore glasses as I did. She thought the doll was contaminated. She wouldn't allow her children to touch it. My bed was thrown out, along with sofas, chairs, anything upholstered. My clothes were taken away to be cleaned. I took the medals and insignia off my husband's army uniform for safekeeping. I didn't know if I could put them back in the right places. It had never been cleaned before. My apartment was cleaned again, this time by Baptists from Georgia. It was free, part of their service to God. After 4 months, I moved back. The front of the building was closed off. New refrigerator, new linoleum in the kitchen, new wallpaper and carpeting in the hall. No one knew what was embedded in the old things, what might show up later, appearing suddenly, like bugs and flour and cereal. The subways were gone. A free shuttle bus ran north and south. There we could connect with trains or buses to go east or further north. They checked the air, but we knew they lied about the results. The Red Cross gave us a gift of cleaning materials, a $50 certificate to a supermarket, and a teddy bear. Everyone was giving out teddy bears, even the insurance company. I was lost for 2 years. Project Liberty, 9/11 Fund, Health Registry, EPA, FEMA, HEPA vacuum cleaners, air filters, Red Cross, support groups, new furniture, new rugs, insurance claims, new paint on the walls, books clean, nightmares, the new reality. Looking up whenever I heard a plane, looking out each morning to see if the Statue of Liberty was still there, arguing with the cable company which charged me for the months I wasn't there because I never called to cancel, using my cell phone because no one could get through even though the phone rang. The first anniversary, watching from a window of an empty apartment. I did not hang an American flag from my window, as we were asked to do. Looking up at the twin beams of light once, that was enough. Crying when people were kind. Crying when the palm trees were planted in the restored winter garden. It's not the same. The trees are smaller, the marble is different, the stores are empty, and the Asian wedding parties where the photographers and white limousines with bride dolls on the hoods have not come back. Crying as the last piece of twisted steel went down the ramp while everyone stood at attention. I had a past, memories I couldn't forget, images I couldn't erase. They came unbidden, ghosts, like the outline of the towers, showing me the way home. I still look for them when I drive down West Street. I made new friends, people I had only known casually before, neighbors who had also been there. I learned to sleep resigned to the possibility of another attack. I learned to put up with tourists who blocked the streets, shouting into their cell phones, "Guess where I am?" I learned to avoid the public commemorations that bring extra security, concrete barriers, and diverted bus routes. I learned not to tell strangers where I live, because then they ask, "Were you there? What was it like?" They're looking for a connection I can't give. I learned not to cry when I pass our 10-house fire station. I learned to close the windows and pull down the blinds when I hear bagpipes outside my window in the police memorial. I learned to forgive those who told me I had to forget, those who compared me to Job's wife, those who ask me why I don't move, those who can't understand that I don't want vengeance, only justice, punishment to fit the crime, though I'm not sure what that is. Survival is not enough. I want meaning. I want to feel safe at home. All things are lost in time, people too, but the past is always with us, making its way through the crust of memory. Sometimes a twisted weed, sometimes a flower, a collage of what used to be. I hold on to what I can. I hold on to keep from getting lost.
Helen Engelhardt. In 1980, my husband and I moved into our new home in the South Midwood section of Brooklyn. On our right lived an interracial couple, the wife from Jamaica, the husband from Cairo, Egypt. Tall, thin, soft-spoken, very courtly in his manners. Mr. Karubi and I used to meet usually in the morning when I was taking out the garbage pails to the curb, and he was warming up his four-door maroon sofa on wheels. Good morning, Miss Helen. How are you? Mr. Karubi was always traveling. He imported and exported foodstuffs to and from the Middle East. The Karubi family have lived for over 1,400 years in Algeria and Egypt and Libya and Palestine and Tunisia. Cherub means carob. Carobs are tough, but sweet, just like Mr. Cherubi. In 1988, my husband, returning from a visit with his relatives in England, became a passenger on Pan Am Flight 103. In the days, weeks, months, years that followed, Mr. Karubi did everything he could think of to help me. You don't give me anything to do for you. Soon as he saw me leaving my house, he would leave his with his ignition key in his hand and drive me wherever I needed to go, even if it were only to the subway station. Because my husband had been killed by a bomb planted by people from the Middle East, for me, it was very necessary to get to know people of goodwill from that part of the world. And so when the Dialogue Project began in Brooklyn in the spring of 2001, I joined it. Jews, Muslims, Christians, Israelis, and Palestinians, we meet once a month to talk about the crisis in the Middle East, to get to know one another as individuals, and to listen to one another's stories. In the spring of 2003, I helped to form a dialogue circle in my own neighborhood, and so I invited Mr. Cherubi to join it. And so it was on September 24th, 2003, in front of a lot of people he did not know, Mr. Cherubi, after 23 years, told me who he really was, where he really came from. I born in Jerusalem in 1928. I attend to Damascus University in Arabic language and literature. I get my master in 1955. Let me tell you how we became refugees. I born in Rumema, which is outside the walls of Jerusalem. My father, he has four apartments. We live then, Jews, Arabs together. In 1947, when the English Mandate finished, then the Israelis, the Jews, the Arabs, they began to fight together. So Mr. Cohen, he's a very good friend. He works with my father. We eat together. The children play together. He says to my father, they are coming. They are going to fight here. I am scared for you. I don't want your children to be killed. You have to leave. My father, he take it serious. We ate 6 o'clock that night. We were on our way 11 o'clock that night. We don't pack anything, just some food and water. We take the key to our house. We give the other keys to Mr. Cohen. He says, you'll be back. I take care of everything for you until you come back. We walk all night long, 60 kilometers through the hills. I carry my child on my shoulders, my mother, my father, my two sisters, my brother, my wife, my uncle, and my aunt. My uncle's wife comes from a little village called Dur al-Kara, which is near Ramallah, and so we go there. The Red Cross is in Ramallah, and they come to Dur al-Kara, and they say, we want to start a school here, and they choose me to be the teacher for the boys. And so they sit on stones and I begin to teach them. Then the United Nations come, sets up a camp for the refugees called Jelazon Camp, and I work 3 jobs there. I take care of the food, I take care of the school, I take care of general managing of the camp. They never come to Ramallah, but they are there in Ramayma, and there is no communication, no telephone, nothing. So from 1947 to 1967, we can't go back and we know nothing about our home. 67 war, they take the West Bank, the borders are open, I go back. I take a bus from Dar al-Qarra to Ramallah, from Ramallah to Jerusalem, and then I walk from the Jaffa Gate. And it's there. After 15 years, the apricot tree is still there. I ring the bell. A man, he comes to the door, he's wearing a uniform, he's got stars on his chest, and he says in Arabic, "Who are you?" And I say, "I'm Ahmad Tarubi, this is my father's home, and I came to see it." And he says, "It was your father's home. It's my home now. I bought from the government for $5,000 to pay back in 20 years. How you feel? My family was there for 200 years. When you grow up in a house, you born there, you raised there. It's your house. And then there's other people are there and they say, no, it's our house, not your house anymore. How you feel? You feel a little angry, you know? I never go back. I stay in the Jelazon camp for 20 years. The United Nations start a school for boys and for girls. They make me in charge. I have 25 teachers working under me. 1 o'clock in the morning, my aunt knock on the door. "Ahmad, wake up, there's police here." I'm in my pajama, I go to the door. There are two men with machine guns. "Are you Ahmad Karubi? Come with us, the commissioner wants to see you." My wife starts to cry. I say, "I'll be back, I'll be back." They take me. The commissioner office, I am the only person like me there. They're just soldiers. They talk to me about my job. I tell them what I do there. They ask who do I work for. I tell them the name of my boss and so on and so on. And then I tell you the truth. They put something on my face I can't see, and they take me, I don't know, a day, a week, I don't know, 3 weeks. It's cold where I am. There's concrete floor. There's a thin blanket. The food is terrible. This toilet smells. I don't see the sun. And then they take me back to the station, and there is the same man again. And he says, "You've been gone for 40 days. You can go home now." 2 days later, 2 o'clock in the morning, they come back again, and they say, "If you don't leave within 24 hours, we will take you back to jail." So I have a visa to the U.S. for 6 months, and I go. How you feel? You leave your family, you leave your house, you leave your job, you leave your friends, you leave your land. I come here, believe me, with $50, my suit, my passport, a piece of chocolate in my pocket, none. My family, they can't go anywhere. My wife can't go. My children can't go. So I have to divorce. It's a forced divorce. I can only stay for 6 months. Now I can marry again and stay. How you feel? I don't see my children for 7 years. Our group is electrified. They had never heard anything like this. In fact, only one of us, Sister Celia, who belongs to a Roman Catholic order called the Sisters of Zion, dedicated to furthering relations between Christians and Jews, has been there. But I am stunned, because why did Mr. Karubi make me believe he was from Egypt all these years? And I ask him this. "Miss Helen, we don't know each other deep. We say hello, good morning, but we don't know each other. When Meir Kahana was killed, his followers started burning the houses of Palestinians all across the country. I'm scared. You're Jewish. I think you'll say you're my Palestinian neighbor and they'll come and hurt me. I let it be." And then I think, you know, I lose my family. I lose my home. I lose my friends, I lose everything, and I'm not a happy person with the Jews. But then you change me. Your husband is killed, and you're supposed to be angry, and you become a peacemaker. You are supposed to hate Arabs. You don't hate me, even though you think I'm Egyptian. You changed my page. I think, why to be this way? I think no one in my family is killed. This lady, her husband is killed, and she is a peacemaker. I see this in your eyes, not the words you say. Excuse me, I have to go home now. My wife is not well. We sat for a few minutes in silence after he left. And then Sister Celia looked at me and she said, "Where I come from, we call that grace. Mr. Karubi and me."
Great, just who I wanted to follow. I'm David Gates. I'm a fiction writer. I also work for Newsweek. And this is a piece that I wrote in 2003, back during that weird time that you may remember. When the war wasn't quite on, but everybody knew it was going to go down, and nobody knew when, but they knew. I'd hardly remembered that. You think? Okay. So, this is what I wrote for the Newsweek website. Last night I skipped the president's news conference in favor of dinner at the Union Square Cafe. Washington State oysters, two Italian goat's milk cheese, drifting all the while along a lazy river of French wine. I cabbed it home, went to sleep, and had a dream. I'd taken my father to Yankee Stadium, and our seats turned out to be in a remote corner of left field. I didn't see until just now how funny that is. I was about to sit down when Mickey Mantle, who knew he was still playing, hit a long drive way over the fence. It bounced somewhere behind me, and I retrieved it, and the ball was strangely old, the leather cracked and brown. I wondered if this would be his last home run and what I could get for the ball on eBay. I'm putting in this part just so you know it really was an actual dream and not some stupid writerly conceit. At any rate, from this part of Yankee Stadium you could see Manhattan. And I saw an airplane, some antiquated bomber with propellers like a B-29, fly north over the city, low to the skyline, and drop two fat bomb-shaped bombs. Stop me if I'm boring you, okay? We all hate when people go on and on about their dreams. One bomb missed and went into the river, clearly an amateur job. The other took out the Upper West Side, a part of town I don't like, though I have friends there. I warned my father, who is actually now my friend Sam, who lives on the Upper West Side, not to look at the fireball. I looked long enough to see white light. Then the stadium and the sky went dark. Then you heard the blast. They got a bunch of us onto the one subway that was still running. I don't know what happened to Sam. And somehow it led us out over in New Jersey, where we had a better view of the skyline. The Empire State Building was still standing, but everything north of about 57th Street had been nude descending a staircase into some twisted Frank Gehry-like mess. I don't like Frank Gehry either. Jump cut. Then we were actually in the city, a small group of survivors, including an old used-to-be and one of my never-wases. This gives the piece some needed oomph, yes? Trying to find shelter in the rubble. A couple of Newsweek people were there, and we agreed we'd have to hunt up some place to put out a special issue. We came across a day's worth of food, not up to Union Square standards, in somebody's ruined refrigerator. My gentle dog, Jesse, was there. He picked out a smaller dog, a Wheaton or something, killed it humanely and began to eat. Somebody said, I need to get out of here right now. Things that aren't any of your business happen with the old used to be and the never was. The never was, now and is, developed evil-looking maroon burn splotches on her hands, then her face. But she'd thought long ago to buy a suicide kit on the internet, which she was all too willing to share with the used to be. I looked at my own hands, same blotches. Then another bomb, this one trucked in apparently, took out the main Con Ed plant, and everything went dark again, and from there on it gets vague. I went wandering, saw other starving dogs all wagging their tails for me to take care of them, and tried to wake myself up. I woke up. It was a bright, sunny Friday morning. My first thought was, this is what we might be calling down on ourselves if millions and millions of angry people in the Middle East should somehow happen to misunderstand what we are about to do in Iraq. My second thought was, this is more or less what's going to happen, for real, in Baghdad, from everything you hear very soon now.
I'm Masha Hamilton, and I'm going to read a little bit from my second novel, The Distance Between Us. It's about a war journalist covering conflict. She's remained apart from the violence until a colleague of hers has been killed. And this is a demonstration that takes place near Bethlehem based on some of my own experiences. The demo car pulls up, delivering fresh stones and bottles to the protesters. Its driver, his features hidden behind a ski mask, fires a rifle into the air and draws cheers from the crowd. He fires again toward the Israeli checkpoint, then hits the gas, raising dust and sending his car skidding away. The calls to Allah, chanting, and obscenities become louder. Allah Akbar, kill the Zionists. God and gunfire, the combustible combination. Pete scoots forward occasionally to grab a shot from behind the shelter of a demonstrator, but mainly he paces within his invisible safety zone. Safety zone, what a pathetic concept, like trying to walk between raindrops. What would Marcus shoot if he were here? Because he would be here. He sometimes covered 3 clashes a day. He had incredible stamina, for which he credited those boxes of raisins. He'd look for the dead and wounded, of course, but also for pictures of the youngest demonstrators, the 9- and 10-year-olds. They'd argued about that, the two of them. Why always the kids, like they're the only ones here? Why not the men? With their sneers and pockmarked faces? No. For me, the children are the story. She squints and can nearly see Marcus joining this dangerous dance, his hands cupping the lens the way a florist might an orchid, his face pressed to the viewfinder, staring through the lustful eye of his camera, absorbed in the poetry of the scene. Stones arcing beneath tear gas canisters, click. Molotov cocktails answered by rubber bullets, click. Night-haired boys pitched against their helmeted half-brothers on an ancient battlefield, 1 or 2 folding to the stained ground, click, click, click. She inches closer to the crowd, as Marcus would, crouches, processing the scene from various angles. An Israeli soldier lunges from behind his concrete barricade and with the skill of a starting pitcher hurls a tear gas canister with one arm and a stun grenade with another. He swears in Hebrew, a long slur that sounds like a medieval curse. Caddy's eyes are watering. A Palestinian boy with a pink scar from eye to jawbone grabs Caddy's arm and offers a dampened bandana as protection against the acrid tear gas. Caddy ties it around her nose and mouth and inhales deeply from under the bandana. Wrapped around her face like that, it becomes a disguise that frees her. She begins to drift among the protesters like an invisible vapor, taking in their mood. Determination, yes, but also playfulness. They are, after all, mostly kids. A heightened sense of drama, too, runs between them. One of them may die today, so these moments must be full, valiant, colorful. A boy uses a rock to scratch a hand of Fatima in the dirt and then flings a stone toward the Israeli checkpoint with a cry. Two others hold their wrists together for a moment in what seems to be a gesture of solidarity before dashing closer to the soldiers. 3 feet away from her, a bullet hits a Palestinian boy in his right shoulder. He looks to be about 12. The force drives him to the ground, and he falls with a sickening thud. He opens his mouth, but no sound emerges, and then he is hit again, this time in his groin. Blood splatters as though from the brush of a careless painter. He curls up and rolls onto his stomach. At the exit wound on his shoulder blade, a red spot appears through his clothing, then blooms like a flower, but fast, like one of those speeded-up nature films. She is closest to him, and she moves toward him. Got to drag him to an ambulance. Then she draws back. What she's got to do is not assist the boy, but pay attention to the air, turning frantic with keffiyehs and curses, the tear gas stink replaced by the syrupy odor of blood, the guns of the Israeli soldiers now swinging slowly from right to left and back again. She has to be able to report it all. Why, though, is no one helping the boy? Finally, after what seems like a dozen minutes, several young men make their way to him and half lift, half drag him to the ambulance about a block away. The boy is not crying, not even whimpering, and what that costs him is etched on his face. Get back! She turns toward Pete's voice and realizes she is standing 6 yards in the open without cover. 4 boys stoop nearby behind 2 burned trash barrels. She drops to a crouch and scuttles to join them. They barely glance at her, intent on their stone throwing. Now more tear gas, more coughing. The barrel she's hunched behind is hit dead on by a bullet. It lurches like a man punched in the stomach. She feels a stare hot on the side of her neck and turns toward the shops. A girl, perhaps 9 years old, stands watching. Despite the distance between them, everything about the child is magnified. Long lashes, tiny hands, old straw basket on her arms. Caddy should be where the girl is, instead of kneeling in the center of this street. But she wants to be closer to the violence than that, as close as possible. This rush is unmatchable. Far better than drugs or alcohol, better than collecting quotes like spent ammo after the fighting is finished. The talcum dirt under her knees, the suspended smoke, the wide-eyed child, the percussion of her own heart, every element in this moment is rich and essential. She peeks out to judge the distance of the soldiers and catches sight of a rifle pointed in her direction. She ducks back. The boys are grinning at her now. One tugs her sleeve, pulling her gently to a safer position. She scrunches up more tightly behind the barrel. Another shot ricochets off its metal side. "Bang, you dead," one of the kids teases in English, his smile friendly. She laughs back, tosses her head, and closes her eyes in a mock dead posture. A siren fused with a woman's wail is the coda. As if the movement were prearranged, the protesters retreat, like closing credits. Sometimes it goes on until nightfall, but this time they've decided to end it early, share a meal, who knows, maybe log on and read a backlog of email. Her boys, the ones she took cover with, wave as they run off. "See you next time, lady," one calls. "You've got a date," she answers, doubting that he understands the slang. Thank you.
Can we lower this? Or just like this? How are you guys tonight? Yeah. Good? Thank you so much for coming and supporting this event. It's a very important event, and it's very good to have you here. Every time I call home, usually the usual conversation is I'd say hello, and you know, whoever answers the phone would say, "Ahlan, Habibti, how are you today?" And I would say, "Good, good, where are you?" I'm like, "Are you in New York?" I'd say, "Yes, I'm in New York. How are you? How are you?" Before you tell me, you have to come very soon to Palestine. We have very good mishmish, apricot jam, shish berek wedding for you. Come. "Are you settled yet? No children? Haram." This is our customary conversation about every week. But then I would tell him, of course, "How are you?" And he would say, "Very bad." I'm like, "What do you mean? What happened from last week?" "Things are worse." unfortunately, usually things are. When I last went in February, March, it was one of the hardest trips. I mean, in the last, you know, especially since the second Intifada, every time I go, things have gotten worse and worse. This last trip when I went, I landed in Ben Gurion Airport, and of course they have a new airport, a very beautiful new airport, and you always have very mixed feeling when you're landing there. Of course, after 4 or 5 hours waiting, I go outside and I drive to my hometown, Bethlehem. And this time the wall was up, completely up, with a new security check. You know, it's not really a checkpoint. It's basically like entering a prison. And they have this big sign that says, "Peace be upon you." So I enter Bethlehem. And of course, this town is a very tiny town, and not only has Bethlehem shrunk, but also we feel it incredible, because unlike, for example, even Ramallah, you don't see the wall as much like in Bethlehem. You really feel the wall. And I go to see the schools and the children, because that's where life is, and just like in the Beirut war, which was basically children who died and women. In Palestine, it's the children, and I go speak to them. And most of the new generation have never been to Jerusalem. When I ask them what they want to do, they, you know, what is their dream? They say, "I would like to go to Al-Quds, to Jerusalem," which is only 15 minutes away, and it's a sister city to Bethlehem, really. And now we don't have no access to it. And I look at these kids, and I don't know what to tell them. When they ask me, "You do so much, I want to do that much," and I don't know how to respond to that. And the feelings are very difficult. There's 3.5, we hear about dialogue tonight, there's 3.5 million people behind a wall. And with a wall, I don't see how we can dialogue. This is a poem against the wall. Every day a crueler hour. The fencing of hearts barely beating. The palpitation of leaves in our dry garden. The heat in Gaza, in Jericho. Keeping dreams we never had the time to remember. An old woman trying to revive any fantasy she can. Another thinking of her husband lost nowhere she can imagine. Men over barbed wires who stop answering when we scream their name. Too busy trying to cross the checkpoints, the soldiers, the day, the night. While others drink tea, talk about curfews, women, the children they buried. While a mother asks what she will tell the child inside of her that she wish it did not come. We witness October in flames, and every other month following is the same. The streets we walk through, a reminder of who we are and what they will never make of us. Human portraits in corners we forget to look at or forget to reach. Pictures stuck on walls as if they belong nowhere. A groom and a bride forced to wed anywhere but where they should. And yet we keep asking what victory blows candles out. What sea speaks of another sea. Even if they raise the wall higher than we can reach, we only know one home, even if we take different routes each time. The tree guides us, the wind guides us, the sun and the moon guide us, and when we arrive, we find the books we cannot stop reading, the embroideries the refugees made, the kitchen where our lives were lived, a marriage proposal, a death, a birth. And every day, as we brew our morning coffee, we greet each other properly and chase the wall from our breath. Thank you. And I'm just going to end with one short poem for peace. Even. Nothing is even. Even this line I'm writing. Even this line I'm waiting in. Waiting for permission to enter the country, the house, the room. Nothing is even. Even now that laws have been drawn and peace is discussed on high tables. And even if all was said to be even, I would not believe. For even I know that nothing is even. Not the trees, the flowers, not the mountains or the shadows. Our nature is not even. So why even try to get even? Instead, let us find an even better place and call it even. Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Benny Kirschenbaum. I'm going to read an essay of Natalia Ginsburg's. that was written during the time that she and her family were in exile in the Abruzzi from Rome. And I'm just going to read pieces of it, but I think I put them together in a way that makes sense. When I first came to the village, all the faces seemed the same to me. The women, rich and poor, young and old, all looked alike. Nearly all had missing teeth. The women down there lose their teeth at 30 from hard work and poor nutrition, as well as from the strains of childbirth and nursing babies that come one after the other relentlessly. As the first snows began to fall, a slow sadness took hold of us. Our lot was exile. Our city was far away. Our books, our friends, the shifting ups and downs of a real existence, all far away. We would light our green stove with the long pipe running across the ceiling. We used to gather in the room with the stove. We cooked and ate there. My husband wrote at the big oval table, and the children scattered their toys on the floor. A picture of an eagle was painted on the ceiling, and I would stare at the eagle, thinking that that was exile. Exile was the eagle. It was the humming green stove. It was the vast, silent countryside and the motionless snow. At 5 o'clock, the bells of the Church of Santa Maria rang, and the women with their black shawls and red faces went to prayers. Every evening, my husband and I took a walk. Every evening, arm in arm, our feet plunged in snow. The people on our street were all friendly and familiar and would come to their doors to greet us. A good evening to you. Now and then someone would ask, well, when are you going back home? My husband would say, when the war is over. And when will this war be over? You're a professor. You know everything. When will it be over? In winter, some old person would die of pneumonia, the bells of Santa Maria tolled the death knell, and Domenico Oreccio, the carpenter, built a casket. A woman went crazy and was taken to the asylum at Calamaggio, and the whole town talked about it for quite a while. She was young and clean, the cleanest woman in the village. They said that must have been because of her great cleanliness. Rosa, the school caretaker, had a neighbor who spit in her eye, and she went around with a bandage on it in order to collect damages. Eyes are sensitive and spit is salty, she explained. And they talked about this for quite some time, too, until there was nothing left to say. We grew more homesick every day. Letters from our city came bearing news of weddings and deaths we couldn't take part in. At times, the nostalgia turned sharp and bitter, turned into hatred. But we kept this hatred hidden, knowing it to be unjust. I told the children about our city. They were very small when we left and had no memories of it. I told them how the houses had many floors and there were lots of streets and buildings and beautiful stores. But here we have Giraud's, the children said. Giraud's shop was right opposite our house. Giraud stood in the doorway like an old owl, his round, impassive eyes fixed on the street. He sold a little of everything, groceries, candles, postcards, shoes, oranges. In February, the air grew damp and soft. Heavy gray clouds drifted across the sky. The end of winter awakened a vague restlessness in us. Maybe someone would come to visit. Maybe something would finally happen. Surely our exile, too, must have an end. There is a certain dull uniformity in human destiny. The course of our lives follow ancient and immutable laws with an ancient, changeless rhythm. Dreams never come true, and the instant our dreams are shattered, we realize how the greatest joys of our life lie beyond the realm of reality. The instant they are shattered, we are sick with longing for the days when they flamed within us. Our fate spends itself in this succession of hope and nostalgia. My husband died in Regina Coeli prison in Rome a few months after we left the village. When I confront the horror of his solitary death, of the anguished choices that preceded his death, I have to wonder if this really happened to us. We, who bought oranges at Giraud's and went walking in the snow. I had faith then in a simple, happy future, rich with fulfilled desires, with shared experiences and ventures. But that winter in the Abruzzi was the best time of my life, and only now that it's gone forever, do I know it.
I'd like to introduce the next reader. Bernice is going to begin now. Bernice, I'm going to give the microphone to you.
Hi, good evening. Thank you all for coming out tonight. I'm very happy to be a part of this. I often wonder sometimes when I watch the news, and I try not to watch the news, that our creator must be very miffed with us. But then you have events like this, and I think that puts a smile on his face. I'm going to read a poem by Marjorie Stamm Rosenfeld. It's called Thirst, and it begins this way. Beneath the Holy Land, where even water wars are fought, the troubled springs run deep, and water, which has properties to wear on stone, has split the rock. Lord, my shepherd. About suffering, Stephen Grass said, suffering is like salt, bitter in a glass. Become a lake instead, then sip the water. You'll see how sweet it tastes, with hardly any hint of bitterness. The Jaffa oranges are sweet and bigger than grenades. We've moved our fences farther in. Our neighbors claim the land we left, then ours. Besides the still waters, Sbarro Pizza, where a young man opens his coat, says to the girl behind the counter, know what this is? So like the exhibitionist who bears his misused, misplaced instrument of love explosively, he maketh me to lie down in green pastures. Tents of Palestinians are buffeted by angry winds. Their throats are parched. The houses of Palestinians collapse. In the house of the Lord. Another scene. From one side comes a swarthy man. From the other, one more swarthy man. Sons of the same father. They face off, raise their instruments, and aim. Which will give ground? Which will strike the other first? Raging thirst propels them. Nearby, the only lake that's fresh and clear is Lake Tiberias, called the Sea of Galilee. It, too, is troubled water. Further south, the sea is dead and full of salt. How many Abrahamic sons must fall? Bombs bloom. The wolves that used to roam the Russian steppes are here, through the valley of the shadow. A great tree arches over the River Jordan. It is the tree of the Jewish people. It is the tree of the Palestinian people. Its leaves shudder in the wind. On every leaf, a name. Thank you.
I'm Evelyn Shaker, and I'm going to be reading from an autobiographical essay that is called At Home and Away, 13 Takes on Growing Up Arab in America. And in my case, that means Lebanese because my parents were immigrants from Lebanon. And it's, as you can tell from the title, divided into sections that are relatively disjointed. I'm not going to read the whole essay. I'll only read a few sections that I thought might be in keeping with the theme tonight, sections that indicate how from my childhood, from a very early age, what we call the conflict in the Middle East was a part of my consciousness. It was something that even a child could not escape. And also, the sections also show, I think, that although we were a very closely knit, tightly knit community, nevertheless, there were from time to time individual Jewish people who came within the orbit of our family and our community, and somehow that was okay. We made peace with that. So I'm going to begin with the second section, actually. My Uncle Yusuf, a gentleman, loved America, but hated Catholics, Democrats, and Jews. Mention the Pope to him, he'd come close to spitting. Jews, of course, were the usurpers, planting themselves on Arab land, which explained, too, his venom towards Democrats and Harry Truman in particular, who'd waited all of 11 minutes before saying yes when Jews in Palestine declared themselves a state. My uncle Yusuf loved his suburban garden. He grew vegetables for his wife and flowers for the joy of it. Flashy blooms, dahlias, giant chrysanthemums, and ruffled peonies. He cradled their heads in his huge hands. He cooed to them like a lover. Their enemies were his enemies. He picked off Japanese beetles with his bare fingers and drowned them in a can of kerosene. He called them Trumans. My Uncle Yusuf loved me. One day, when it was just the two of us in his car, he asked the standard question, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" To be funny, I said, "President." He said, "Why not?" A window in my mind flew open. I began to think things I'd never thought before. This is section 3. To American diplomats who urged Truman to hold off on recognizing Israel, he cited the wishes of American Jews. "I am sorry, gentlemen, but I have to answer to hundreds of thousands who are anxious for the success of Zionism. I do not have hundreds of thousands of Arabs among my constituents." On a Christmas show back in the 50s, Perry Como croons carols on TV, but also works in Jewish folk songs. My father, passing through the living room, overhears. "Jews," he explodes, "do they control everything?" I go into my bedroom and slam the door. Only years after he died did I begin to understand what it felt like for my father to be an Arab in the United States, reminded in every editorial on every channel that on matters that mattered, he could have no political voice. Good that he didn't live to see 67 and Israel's six-day blitzkrieg against Syria and Egypt, when newsmen and even comics on American TV gloated openly at Israel's victory, when Arabs were mocked pitilessly. The early 70s, Palestinians are hijacking airliners and planting bombs. After one horrific attack, I'm on a bus riding through a Boston neighborhood where Syrians and Lebanese have lived for decades. An old man climbs on. He is drunk and disheveled. "Oh, Arabs," he cries out in Arabic, swaying from one overhead strap to another. His tears spill. "Oh, brothers, what have you done?" The driver, who has understood nothing, mutters an ethnic epithet and puts him off the bus. 5. My father's best fishing buddy was Mr. Rosenfield, who sold silk ties and held his pants up with suspenders. Before dawn on a Saturday, his black Pontiac would drive down our street, and my father, who'd been at the window watching for headlights, would flick off the porch light and be out the door. Gear loaded, the two were off for the day, out after white perch and striped bass, freshwater fish. Forget the sea. Cape Cod had 365 bodies of water, my father claimed. A new one for each day of the year. When they arrived at their special spot, the sun just rising, the morning mist still on the lake, they spread out along the shore in opposite directions. Mirror images, clumsy figures in waist-high fishermen's boots wading cautiously into water. Product of shtetl or mountain, neither man knew how to swim. But they knew rule number one, don't talk, don't call out, don't scare the fish. At noon, under a fringe of trees, They unrolled a patchwork blanket of wool remnants my mother had pieced together on her sewing machine, pulled out sandwiches wrapped in wax paper, fried eggplant for my father, something that smelled of fish for Mr. Rosenfield, hard-boiled eggs, whole tomatoes they bit into like apples, thermoses of sweet black coffee, cinnamon buns picked up the day before from a favorite bakery. Afterwards, my father puffing on his pipe, Mr. Rosenfield his cigarette, they relaxed into conversation. What did they talk about then, this Arab and this Jew? Rods and reels, maybe. Lures and live bait. Irish politicians. Thank you.
Wendy Orange, too loud, okay? I have to say this has been fantastic. I lived in Israel for 9 years in the 90s, and then my daughter got dyslexic and we had to come back, and it was kind of a nightmare for me to leave Israel. I waited 9 years for her to go to college. I moved back last June, and things are so bad over there that all of our races and all of us here can have conversations that we no longer can have there. Most of my book, which I am supposed to read from, is about dialogue work in Nablu, in Beit Sahor, in Jerusalem. Amazing, amazing stories. And I want to thank you, I'm not good with names, for bringing me back to dialogue, because it was amazing. And all of you who read were just great. And by the way, the Palestinian woman from Bethlehem, that first phone call with your family was so Jewish. And that's what we learned in dialogue. I also... Yes.
I have to concur with that. My family would have said the exact same thing. Thank you.
Anybody else want to get up? Because I'm very happy to give up my place. I want to introduce one of my best friends, Lily Rivlin, who's here tonight. Her film, she's made many films, but her film that was shown at the Jerusalem Film Festival in June, this past June, is all about Palestinian and Israeli women activists. Would you stand, Lily? And thank you for coming. So she should feel right at home here. And, okay. Now, I took the 6 minutes very seriously. My book was out of print, and I just got the rights reverted to me. So, yes. I was going to read from the last chapter, which has Jews and Palestinians, Israelis and Palestinians, up on a hilltop during the building of what Israel calls Har Homa, and Palestinians call Abu Janim, but it was way too long. So then I came up with... The reason I wrote this book, it's called Rabin is Dead. My good friend, who does not want to be introduced, who is Israeli, time me. Blank, blank. So basically, we're not going to get much Rabin in. We're going to get a little of me in, that's all. You all do remember Rabin's death? Okay. So you're not going to get much of him, but read the chapter, and the last chapter is great. We're going to cut out a lot of it. Okay, can you hear me? One day, there is life, and then suddenly it happens, there is death. I'm in my Cambridge study, examining these words on the back jacket of Paul Auster's memoir, Invention of Solitude. 3:30 on a Saturday afternoon, November 4th, 1995. I flip back and forth from the book's opening passage back to this phrase on the cover, when the phone rings. My best friend Marge has just heard on BBC News that minutes ago Rabin was shot. They don't know if he'll live. I'm alone in the house, usually filled with Israelis and others. My dog Harry is lying beside me, asleep on the floor. I start howling, guttural sound so loud that they seem to me to be coming from someone else. Harry slinks under the chair as Marge is still on the phone saying, "Are you okay?" shouting, "Are you okay?" On TV, Yitzhak Rabin is not yet dead, and then he is. Skip, 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 skip. Okay, not don't skip. I try to get on an LL flight, and I quite love LL for security as well as for, it used to be just kind of wild and fun and nobody followed rules. And on this particular night, already immediately after his death, it was all filled. So I took a Swiss Air flight. It was the only flight left, and we stopped over in Zurich, in which I see Rabin's coffin coming up from Tel Aviv. And now I'm in Jerusalem. And lots happens in between, but not important. Okay. I go to visit my friend Yehuda, a painter who is often anti-Arab, then other times he's pro-Arab, and Arab is the word that people who really don't know the situation use for Palestinians. I try never to do that. Okay. And we start walking. Finally, we arrive at Rabin's coffin. It's brightly lit, circled by hundreds of lit candles, bouquets, handwritten letters. I myself write a farewell note after we stand at the closed coffin. We move on. I'm drawn to gaze up at the sky. In the almost full moon, Rabin's face seems to be shining down from that lunar surface. I stare at what remains of his determined expression, that trademark half-smile everybody remarks upon. The impression, sorely weird, is also soothing. Searching for our car, we climb along with hundreds of others over concrete sites, mounds of dirt and sand lit only by moonlight. As if choreographed, we move nimbly, like astronauts, I say to Yehuda, who looks around and nods. We all seem to be moving without gravity, without noise, without feeling, as if in layers of padded grief that are keeping all emotions at bay. I get into bed in Yehuda's guest loft, he's not my lover, just as dawn is rising. In this November heat wave, I hear the birds of Jerusalem, one of the most intimate sounds I know. Whenever I was in pain there, when I lived there permanently, I mean supposedly permanently, I was drawn to these unusually melodic little creatures, just little birds that hop merrily about. The birds are greeting this terrible day. Only I can't fall asleep. So I return to Oster's Invention of Solitude, picking up where I left off yesterday, what seems a month ago. I read over again. One day there is life, and then suddenly it happens, there is death. Skip, 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 skip. I never learned to write short. Okay. I wake each morning in morbid disbelief. I can't accept that Rabin is dead. One midday during the first week in Jerusalem, this first week of Shiva morning, I feel restless and drive aimlessly. Remember that I haven't spoken to a single Palestinian. So these were the days. I drive past Bethlehem's checkpoint and into the town of Beit Zahur, hoping to talk to the dialogue leaders who in fact are there, at a rapprochement center for dialogue which we built and which is no longer visited by anybody. After offering coffee and conversation, we sit comfortably and they tell me that the first phase of Oslo, this is not long after the handshake, 2 years after, phase one is proceeding since Rabin's death 5 days ago with Israeli troops moving out of the cities of the West Bank before schedule instead of the usual stalling. Skip, skip. Okay, we're almost done. I learn that several of my oldest first Palestinian friends from Nablus, how do you say it in Arabic? Arabic? Say again?
Nablus.
How do you say Nablus in
Nablus.
Okay, fine. Okay, I have one paragraph. Okay, I learned that several of my best friends from Nablu, Palestinians, were given press passes, attended the priest's rally, after which Rabin was murdered. They heard the shot and felt the shock waves. Okay, I'm over time, so I'm going to just read the very end. I'm back in Cambridge, Massachusetts, after 2 weeks. in Israel, sitting at a low table facing a photo of Rabin, which I framed with fresh flowers, lit candles. The Shalom Chaver tapes that eulogize him in beautiful Hebrew music are playing in the background and played for the next 5 years for me. I'm trying to bring back the everything I saw in Jerusalem. I feel just like after my parents died. Each died young, and after each death, it was as if the umbrella or the awning or whatever the metaphor is of my universe had been split open, allowing bursts of icy wind to rush in, a coldness that lowered the temperature in all the rest of my life. This coldness is what death leaves, especially the death of someone essential to the small world each of us holds close. Figures, images, and mostly people who keep us intimate with life. Rabin, why was he part of my essential cosmos? Because the peace process he put in motion and the dialogue process that the people put in motion was central to my life. I stare blankly at the table. My eyes land again on, actually it's called The Invention of Solitude, a book I've placed as a reminder of my time. I finished it in Jerusalem. I pick it up and turn to the last page. I see what I have to do now to honor Rabin, to give meaning to what he set in motion, to keep alive my years in Jerusalem. Oster did it. He paces his room in the last page, overwhelmed by grief. He finds words remote. He's unable to write what he knows. He's committing to do so. Writing will be my way too. Such a task seems as necessary as it is impossible. I reread the last lines of his memoir, his words. It was, it will never be again. Underline, remember.
Mine is very short. I'm Joan Silver. I'm sorry. When I'm reading to you, and a bunch of other writers were asked to write a 3-minute piece on the subject of revenge. And my first draft was this little speech about why I was against revenge in all forms. And I quoted from a great speech that Al Gore gave around the time of Abu Ghraib, explaining why revenge was also very detrimental to the avenger. But it turned out what I wrote wasn't what they wanted. They wanted something much more personal and anecdotal. So this is what I ended up writing. When I went to Vietnam as a tourist a few years ago, I visited the War Museum in Ho Chi Minh City, which is filled with photos of atrocities. It also has a room with pictures of protests all over the world, and I was initially eager to let people know I had been in those marches. I can't say that any Vietnamese I met was terribly impressed by this. One guide I said it to had just led a tour of American vets to meet Vietnamese who'd fought against them. The country's own scars of reunification made my volunteer memories very pale. I didn't mention to anyone until the end of my visit that I had an older brother who'd been in Vietnam as a civilian during the war. He was an engineer for a company that made guidance systems for aircraft, and he was sent to figure out why the planes weren't flying right, or so I understand it. My brother, who died 9 years ago, never spoke about it. The one letter he sent was after being shelled in Da Nang, so I did make a point of going to Da Nang. No one, including the taxi drivers at Da Nang Airport, could believe I was actually staying there. So Da Nang has a great museum. It's a rundown, unpretty city, and tourists stay outside. Within an hour of my walking down the main street, everyone in town knew I was American. The news was spread by guys trying to sell me rides on the back of their motorcycles, the standard cheap taxis of Vietnam. Da Nang was the one place people talked about having been on the losing side in the war. One man in his 50s said he'd been a translator for the Americans. One kid in his 20s said his father and his uncle had fought on the southern side. This was an odd feeling for me because I wasn't on that side. You can hear, as I say this, the complications of that. My entanglements crossed each other by belief and by family, as they did for Vietnamese. The boy with relatives who'd fought for the South became my motorcycle chauffeur for a jaunt to Monkey Mountain. He pointed out the pink colonial structure that was his church and the club where he was a DJ at night, and he told me his uncle was in California now and his son was in the army in Iraq. He laughed, as maybe he had a right to, at what he had escaped and at the joke and its never being over, and he looked back at me, unsafely at that speed, to make sure I appreciated the endless, ironic revenge of history, which he was quite used to.
Good evening. My name is Kathy Salton, and I'd like to read a very brief excerpt from Israeli and Palestinian Voices. This is a book that was written after a visit I made to Israel-Palestine, where I interviewed Israelis and Palestinians. Palestinians must come to acknowledge Jewish fears and their need for security, while Israelis must recognize that the only authentic security for them is through justice for the Palestinians. A quote from Naim Atik, Canon of St. George Cathedral, Jerusalem. Peace between Israelis and Palestinians does not require them to agree on the events which comprise their respective histories. Instead, it necessitates a mutual acknowledgement of the injustices each has suffered. Last year at this time, the world witnessed an extraordinary event when, after 38 years of occupation, the Israeli government pulled 7,800 settlers out of the Gaza Strip without any serious incident. Many of the soldiers, sympathetic to the settler movement and the violent protesters, did not want to be seen ejecting fellow Jews from their homes. Yet they performed their duties admirably and with great care so as not to harm the civilian population. The world saw the power of moderation, transcending the forces of extremism, something which had rarely been seen before in Israel. As I watched the coverage on television, I imagined how wonderful it would be if the same moderation were extended to Palestinian civilians at the military checkpoints. In my mind's eye, I saw an Israeli soldier apologizing to a Palestinian man twice his size for having to carry out a body search, or to an old woman obliged to wait hours in a long line in the hot sun. For one fleeting moment, I dared to dream of a day when both peoples would dwell side by side in peace. After all, Jews and Arabs are both indigenous to the Holy Land. And since ancient times have lived as neighbors and often as close relatives through intermarriage. Why then, in the 21st century, is our thinking not more sophisticated? Why can we not create the same amicable living conditions that existed for long periods in ancient times? If the events of the recent years is any indication, it appears that neither the Palestinians nor the Israelis are acting in a reasonable way to make peace happen. In March of 2002, while I was in Jerusalem in the West Bank, Palestinian suicide bombers killed a record 108 Israelis. These human bombs chose to carry out their deadly missions in crowded malls, pizza parlors, and neighborhood cafes. That month, their favorite target appeared to be buses. The bombers chose mornings when the city buses were crowded with students on their way to school, and evenings when commuters were returning home to their families. Because March was unusually hot that year, most bus drivers closed the windows, turned on the air conditioning, which only intensified the blasts and maximized the number of victims. Suicide bombers strap homemade explosives to their torsos. Their bombs are made, packed with bolts, nuts, screws, and pieces of broken machinery capable of inflicting maximum bodily damage in a blast. The explosion, powerful enough to plunge metal shards through necks and rip open major arteries, transforms the bus into an inferno of twisted metal and burning flesh. Under Israel's unilateral withdrawal, their unilateral withdrawal in August of 2005, Khan Yunis was one of 8 refugee camps in the Gaza Strip, where 58,891 Palestinians lived in a very small area, making it the most densely populated place on earth. Khan Yunis is a concrete shantytown. Sewage runs in rivulets down the middle of alleyways. There are no gardens, no places for children to play other than the dunes in front of the neighboring Israeli settlements, which together with the military installations surround Khan Yunis on 3 sides. The dunes dotted on the tops with Israeli gun emplacements and sand-bagged bunkers are surrounded by an electric fence. Israeli soldiers routinely taunt young boys who like to fly their kites along the perimeter of the fence, with racial slurs and invective meant to produce an angry response. The boys run up the sloping dunes to the fence and throw stones, to which the Israeli soldiers reply with their weapons of choice, dart-like needles known as flechettes, which are packed inside shells. On impact, the flechettes spray out a deadly mass, slicing the targets to pieces. In one 24-hour period, Israeli soldiers killed 14 Palestinian children, all under the age of 14. Chris Hedges, Middle East reporter for the New York Times, witnessed such an incident. Children have been shot in other conflicts I've covered, but I have never before watched soldiers entice children like mice into a trap and then murder them on the spot. Currently, there are approximately 5 million Israelis and 4.8 million Palestinians living in Israel proper in the occupied territories. Since these two peoples are not going to disappear, they must find a way to make compromises in exchange for peace.
Thank you all for your support for Seeds of Peace, and thank you for your attention. Johnny Got His Gun is a novel by Dalton Trumbo. It was written in 1938. He was 20 years old. It was at the printer when World War II began, so it was published in a very different climate than the one in which it was written. It was soon after that serialized in the Daily Worker. And it's a novel that's had a curious history because each decade brings a new context for this important novel. Dalton Trumbo himself was blacklisted. The novel was out of print for many years. It had a renaissance at the time of the Vietnam War when there was yet again a new context for thinking about the way Dalton Trumbo wrote about World War I. There was also a movie in 1970. Johnny Got His Gun is about a soldier, a private from a small town in America, who is blown up in the trenches in France. And the entire novel takes place in his mind because he has had his arms amputated and his legs amputated and his face has been blown away and he's deaf and he's blind. So he's just lying in a bed. And the entire novel is his consciousness, his experience, his narrative of how he figures out how he got here. And over a period of years, he sustains himself thinking and understanding. And he develops, finally, a way to communicate using Morse code by moving his head on the pillow. And he communicates his desire, because he's got this worked out, that he would like to travel around the world as an educational exhibit of war. and he is told that this is against regulations and is not permitted, and drugged, and he feels them drugging him. And now, for the first time, he truly despairs and goes mad. This denial drives him mad, and this is how the novel concludes. Why didn't they want him? Why were they shutting the lid of the coffin against him? Why didn't they want him to speak? Why didn't they want him to be seen? Why didn't they want him to be free? It was 5, maybe 6 years now since he'd been blown out of the world. The war must be over by now. No war could last that long, killing so many people. There wouldn't be enough people to kill. If the war was over, then all the dead had been buried and all the prisoners had been released. Why shouldn't he be released too? Why not, unless they figured him as one of the dead? And if that was true, why didn't they kill him? Why didn't they put a stop to his suffering? Why should he be a prisoner? He had committed no crime. What right had they to keep him? What possible reason could they have to be so inhuman to him? Why? And then suddenly he saw. He had a vision of himself as a new kind of Christ, as a man who carries within himself all the seeds of a new order of things. He was the new Messiah of the battlefields, saying to people, "As I am, so shall you be." For he had seen the future, he had tasted it, and now he was living it. He had seen the airplanes flying in the sky, he had seen the skies of the future filled with them, black with them, and now he saw the horror beneath. He saw a world of lovers forever parted of dreams, never consummated of plans that never turned into reality. He saw a world of dead fathers and crippled brothers and crazy screaming sons. He saw a world of armless mothers clasping headless babies to their breasts, trying to scream out their grief from throats that were cancerous with gas. He saw starved cities black and cold and motionless, and the only things in this whole dead, terrible world that made a move or a sound were the airplanes that blackened the sky, and far off against the horizon, the thunder of the big guns and the puffs that rose from barren, tortured earth when their shells exploded. That was it. He had it. He understood it now. He had told them his secret, and in denying him, they had told him theirs. He was the future. He was a perfect picture of the future, and they were afraid to let anyone see what the future was like. Already they were looking ahead. They were figuring the future, and somewhere in the future they saw war. To fight that war, they would need men, and if men saw the future, they wouldn't fight. So they were masking the future. They were keeping the future a soft, quiet, deadly secret. They knew that if all the little people, all the little guys saw the future, they would begin to ask questions. They would ask questions, and they would find answers, and they would say to the guys who wanted them to fight, they would say, "You lying, thieving sons of bitches, we won't fight. We won't be dead. We will live. We are the world. We are the future. We will not let you butcher us, no matter what you say, no matter what speeches you make, no matter what slogans you write. Remember it well. We are the world. We are what makes it go round. We make bread and cloth and guns. We are the hub of the wheel and the spokes and the wheel itself. Without us, you would be hungry, naked worms, and we will not die. We are immortal. We are the sources of life. We are the lowly, despicable, ugly people. We are the great, wonderful, beautiful people of the world. And we are sick of it. We are utterly weary. We are done with it forever and ever, because we are the living, and we will not be destroyed. If you make a war, if there are guns to be aimed, if there are bullets to be fired, if there are men to be killed, they will not be us. They will not be us, the guys who grow wheat and turn it into food, the guys who make clothes and paper and houses and tiles, the guys who build dams and power plants and string the long moaning high tension wires, the guys who crack crude oil down into a dozen different parts, who make light globes and sewing machines and shovels and automobiles and airplanes and tanks and guns. Oh, no, it will not be us who die. It will be you. It will be you, you who urge us on to battle, you who incite us against ourselves, you who would have one cobbler kill another cobbler, you who would have one man who works kill another man who works, you who would have one human being who wants only to live kill another human being who wants only to live. Remember this. Remember this well, you people who plan for war. Remember this, you patriots, you fierce ones, you spawners of hate, you inventors of slogans. Remember this as you have never remembered anything else in your lives. We are men of peace. We are men who work, and we want no quarrel. But if you destroy our peace, if you take away our work, if you try to range us one against the other, we will know what to do. If you tell us to make the world safe for democracy, we will take you seriously, and by God and by Christ, we will make it so. We will use the guns you force upon us. We will use them to defend our very lives, and the menace to our lives does not lie on the other side of a no man's land that was set apart without our consent. It lies within our own boundaries, here and now. We have seen it, and we know it. Put the guns into our hands, and we will use them. Give us the slogans, and we will turn them into realities. sing the battle hymns, and we will take them up where you left off. Not one, not ten, not 10,000, not a million, not 10 millions, not 100 millions, but 1 billion, 2 billions of us, all the people of the world. We will have the slogans, and we will have the hymns, and we will have the guns, and we will use them, and we will live. Make no mistake of it, we will live. We will be alive, and we will walk and talk and eat and sing and laugh and feel and love and bear our children in tranquility and security and decency and peace. You plan the wars, you masters of men, plan the wars and point the way, and we will point the gun.
Bravo, Ms. Weber. I don't think I can say any more than that. That was absolutely it. Thank you so much for staying with us, for being here. I know I found it very healing. And just thank you. Peace among us.
This recording was made available by the New York Sound Posse, online at nysoundposse.com.